What is it? Fitzroy's anguish was unrelenting. What's wrong?
I believe he told me something. He didn't mean to tell me, but I sussed it out.
Lloyd sat up. The few wrinkles in his pinstripe suit smoothed out with the movement. What? What did he tell you?
I know where he's going.
The young American attorney's face slowly widened into a smile. Excellent. He reached for his mobile phone. Where?
There's a catch. This place he's going, only three blokes have ever known about it. One of those blokes is dead. One of those blokes is the Gray Man. And one of those blokes is me. I'll tell you where, but if your little reality show contest doesn't destroy him there, he's going to know I've set him up. Your chaps miss him this time, and it's game over.
Let me worry about that. Tell me where he's going.
Graubünden.
Where the fuck is that? Chapter 16. Song Park Kim had sat motionless in a meditative state while airborne, but his eyes opened, awake and alert, upon touchdown at Charles de Gaulle Airport. The only passenger of the Falcon 50 executive jet, his small, rough hands rested on his knees, and his eyes remained hidden behind stylish sunglasses. His perfectly tailored pinstripe suit fit his environment precisely. The cabin was appointed for executive travel, and he appeared to be a youngish but otherwise unremarkable Asian executive. The Falcon taxied off the runway, down and off the taxiway, past a long row of parked corporate jets, finally turning into an open hangar door. A waiting limousine, still wet from the drizzle of the gray evening, idled in the middle of the hangar. A driver stood alongside. As soon as the jet came to a complete stop and the turbine slowed, the co-pilot made his way back to the seven-seat cabin carrying a nylon gym bag. He sat in front of Song Park Kim and lowered the bag onto a mahogany table between them. Kim said nothing.
I was told to give you this upon touchdown. Immigration has been dealt with. No customs problems. There is a car waiting for you.
A curt nod, nearly imperceptible, from the short-haired Korean.
Enjoy Paris, sir,
said the co-pilot. He stood and retreated to the cockpit. The small partition closed behind him. Alone, Song Park unzipped the bag, pulled out a Heckler & Koch MP7A1 machine pistol. He ignored the telescoping stock and held the weapon like a handgun out in front of him, looking through the gun's simple sight system. Two long, thin magazines, each filled with 20 4.6x30mm hollow-point cartridges, were attached to one another by means of a nylon cinch. He replaced the weapon in the bag. Next, he pulled out a mobile phone and an earpiece. He tucked the earpiece in place on the side of his head and turned it on. The phone he also turned on before slipping it into his coat pocket. A handheld GPS receiver went into another pocket. More MP7 magazines, a suppressor, and a change of clothes remained in the bag untouched. A black-handled, black-bladed folding knife emerged from the bag, and he slipped this into his pocket. 2 minutes later, he sat in the limousine. The driver looked straight ahead as Kim said,
"City Center."
The limo rolled forward towards the hangar doors. Kim was South Korean, an assassin with the National Intelligence Service. He was their best. 5 wet jobs inside North Korea, most of them with no support whatsoever, had built a legend for him in his unit. 7 more operations in China against North Korean sanctions violators, 2 in Russia against purveyors of nuclear secrets, and a few hits on fellow South Koreans in need of permanent attitude adjustments vis-a-vis their nefarious northern neighbors, had made Song Park Kim, at 32, the obvious choice when his leaders were asked to furnish a killer to send to Paris to hunt a killer in exchange for cold, hard cash. Kim did not voice opinions on his assignments. Working alone, he had no one to voice them to,
But were his thoughts solicited, he would have said this mission smelled rotten to the core. $20 million for the head of the Gray Man, a former CIA operative who, he'd heard through the grapevine, had not deserved the sellout he had gotten from his masters. The $20 million was being offered by some European corporation. This was nothing like the nationalistic operations Kim worked throughout his career. Still, Kim knew he was an instrument of South Korea's domestic and foreign policy. His counsel had not been sought, and those whose judgment was valued had decided he should come here to Paris, settle in, wait for a call giving him the Gray Man's whereabouts, and then pour hot bullets into the poor bastard's back. Graubünden is an eastern canton of Switzerland, tucked into a little niche near where the southwestern Austrian border concaves. It is known as the Canton of 150 Valleys, and one of these valleys runs east to west in an area called Lower Engadine. There, the tiny village of Guarda rests atop the sharp ledge of a steep hill high above the valley floor, just miles from both the Austrian and Italian borders. There is only one sheer, winding road up to the little village, and it connects the one-room, whistle-stop train station below to the half-timbered houses above, a laborious 40-minute hike. There are almost no cars in the village, and farm animals greatly outnumber the human residents. Narrow cobblestone roads wind steeply up and between the white buildings, alongside water troughs and fenced gardens. The town ends abruptly, and the steep hill resumes, a meadow that rises to a thick pine forest that itself gives way to rocky cliffs that loom above the town that surveys the valley floor below, and all who pass or approach. The villagers understand German, but among themselves speak Romansh, a language spoken by barely 1% of the 7.5 million Swiss, and virtually no one else on earth. At 4 a.m., a few snow flurries swirled around the little road that led from the valley floor up to Guarda. A lone man, dressed in thick jeans, a heavy coat, and a black knit cap, limped up the steep, winding switchback. A small backpack hung off his shoulders. 10 hours earlier, minutes after speaking with Don Fitzroy from a pink cell phone he'd snatched from the open purse of a staggeringly drunk female university student meandering alone on the sidewalk, Gentry found an outdoor clothing store in Budapest and purchased a full wardrobe, new from the bottom of his leather boots to the top of his black knit cap. Within an hour of leaving Sabot's building, he was boarding a bus at Nepliket bus terminal for the Hungarian border town of Hedeshalom. He climbed out of the bus a half mile from the border, walked north out of the village into a field, and turned left. There was no moon. He had a tactical flashlight in his pack, but did not use it. Instead, he stumbled to the west, walked a mile on his cut feet, could feel the sting and the warm blood squish in his socks and between his cold toes. Finally, just before 8 in the evening, he crossed a field full of modern windmills and found himself in the Austrian border town of Nickelsdorf. He made it into the European Union. It was another mile walk, a limp, really, with a gunshot wound to the thigh and the injured feet and knees, before he found the road. He walked west with his thumb out for a few minutes. A trucker pulled over, but he was heading north and could not help. A second driver, and then a third, were also heading in the wrong direction. At 9:15, he was picked up by a Swiss businessman heading all the way to Zurich. Court told him his name was Jim. The businessman wanted to practice his English, and Court obliged. They talked about their lives and families on the trip across Austria. Court's story was 100% bullshit, but he was a pro. He sold the tale of the messy divorce back in Virginia, the lifelong desire to visit Europe, the mugging in Budapest that cost him his belongings, and his good fortune to still have his wallet and cash and passport, and a friend in eastern Switzerland who could put him up until he caught his plane back home the following week. As they drove through the night and talked, Court kept part of his focus on the side mirror, nonchalantly making sure he'd not been followed. He also, between the BS stories of places he'd never been and people he'd created out of whole cloth,
kept in mind his task at hand. He tried to get his head around the events still to come in the next 30 hours. It was a Friday night. Traffic on the A1 was heavy, but the businessman's Audi was sleek and fast. They skirted to the north of Salzburg. Court offered to drive, and the Swiss businessman caught a couple of hours of sleep. The Audi turned onto the Engadiner Bundesstraße and crossed the northeastern border of Switzerland at 3 a.m. There was no customs control at the Swiss border, though Switzerland was not officially a member of the EU. The Swiss driver pulled into an all-night rest stop, insisting Jim simply must try Swiss beer and give his honest opinion. Court did so, gushed over the body and color and texture, threw in a few other accolades he'd once overheard in a Munich beer garden in reference to German brews, and this convinced the now smitten businessman to take Jim directly to his destination instead of dropping him off once their paths diverged. They took the 180 south and then the 27 west through a valley, though in the overcast night they could see nothing on either side of their headlights. Finally, in the Burg of Laven, Gentry picked a half-timbered house just off the main road and claimed it as his destination. Actually, by climbing out of the warm Audi here, Court was left with a 2-mile walk in the snow. But, he decided, should there be trouble waiting at his real objective, there was no reason for this nice fellow to suffer for his good deed.
"Thanks for the lift. Auf Wiedersehen."
Court climbed out of the car and shook the gentleman's hand through the window. He stood in the road as he waved goodnight. As the taillights of the Audi rounded a corner in the distance, the gray man turned in the opposite direction and began walking westward through a gentle snowfall. He trudged along purposefully, but he was bone-tired. The adrenaline that, along with his discipline, had moved him forward without pause for the past 20 hours, had now given out, and all that remained was the discipline. He needed rest and hoped to find a few hours of it up the steep road in Guarda. By 4:10, the snowfall had picked up. Court was up the hill and in the village now. He saw not a single soul, though there were still some lights on in the little hotel. The lights of the homes of the villagers were all extinguished. The shepherds and the blacksmiths and the innkeepers and the pensioners were sound asleep for a few hours more. He continued on, still climbing higher through the village, past ancient stone water troughs for the sheep flocks that moved through the hamlet's pedestrian-only streets, past the tiny gardens surrounded by tiny fences in front of the tiny homes, until he broke out the other end of town and climbed higher up the steep hill along a dirt path. The evening snow settled on earlier accumulation, and it nearly blanketed the hillside, though even in the moonless night, Gentry could see patches of darkness, bare spots on the prominence that had yet to accept the cover of the white powder. After climbing through the white meadows for 300 yards above Guarda, Gentry clicked on his small tactical flashlight. Behind him was sheer pastureland, but he was now entering a pine forest, and the snow swirling through the trees and the black night made the road invisible ahead of him. The light helped. He pressed forward another 100 yards and found his destination in the woods, a tiny shack. It stood 30 yards from the road, which continued on and up through disused private property. There was no reason anyone else would pass by, and no reason, if someone did, that they would look hard to their right through the forest and notice the simple structure. A huge, rusty padlock hung uninvitingly on the front door. The three windows around the one-room shack were boarded from the inside, and surrounding pines grew unfettered nearly to the edges of the building. Gentry walked through the trees and circled the building with his tack light. At the back of the cabin stood a utility shed, also heavily padlocked, and he checked this and found it secure. Continuing around the structure, he scanned the walls, the wooden slats on the roof, and finally, the front door. He took off his gloves, ran his fingers around the door's edges slowly, and, in the top right corner, he found it. A wooden toothpick jabbed flush with the frame. Had the door been opened, this telltale would have dropped to the ground and given the gray man the tip-off that his cabin had been compromised by visitors. Satisfying himself that the location was secure, Court next turned his back to the front door, took 30 measured steps away into the pines, pushing through the needled branches. At 30 paces, he shifted 5 yards to his right and knelt down. The key was buried in a metal coffee tin, just 6 inches or so below the pine mulch and frozen dirt. He dug it out with a flat rock. After retrieving the key, he returned to the cabin and opened the lock. The interior air was dry and stale and every bit as cold as outside the door. There was a knee-high coal furnace in a corner, but Gentry ignored it. Instead, he lit a lantern on a card table in the center of the room, its dim glow the only warmth to be had. A shelf on the wall held cases of military rations, meals ready to eat, and the 36-year-old American tore into the first MRE he could grab as soon as he came out of the restroom with the chemical toilet. He ate hard crackers and cookies, wolfed them down as he sat alone at the card table. He finished his meal in 90 seconds. Next, he stood and pushed the squat coal furnace out of the corner and lifted the loose floorboards below it. Placing the tactical light in his mouth, he climbed down a wooden ladder exposed with the removal of the floorboards into a dirt-walled basement 6 feet high and 10 feet square. When he turned from the ladder, he faced 3 chest-high stacks of black cases, each case the size of a very large toolbox. This took up nearly half the room in the underground cellar, and a metal workbench filled the space to his right. There was only room to climb up and down the ladder and move sufficiently to manipulate the cases. Court hefted the first container off the first stack, dropped it heavily on the table, and flicked open the latch. Early that morning, when Court told Fitzroy he would rescue his family, he immediately decided to go to Guarda, Switzerland, to his massive weapons cache hidden in the forest. He had a half dozen other stores around the continent, but nothing like Guarda. Guarda was the motherlode, the heavy metal. The first case housed a black Swiss Brueger Antomet MP9 submachine gun. He pulled it out of its foam bed and snapped a loaded magazine into the magwell, affixed the sling to its buttstock, and lifted it over his head to push it outside the trap door onto the floor above him. Another case held a subload, a nylon and canvas rig full of loaded magazines for the weapon that would strap both to his thigh and his utility belt. He tossed this through the hole above him as well. For the next 5 minutes, Court went through case after case. Into a huge duffel he stuffed all manner of small arms and explosives. Into a smaller bag he placed a black tactical suit, a face mask, ballistic eyewear, a small surveillance scanner that would allow him to pick up short-distance communication, and a pair of binoculars. Finally, just before 5 a.m., Gentry climbed out of the basement, following behind the 2 duffels he pushed out in front of him. He left the entrance to the basement cache open. He drank from a half-frozen water bottle, washed down a couple of mild painkillers for his thigh, used the chemical toilet a second time, and pulled a sleeping bag from a shelf. He rolled it out on the floor, unlocked the latch of the front door, prepared the cabin's defenses a bit, and then climbed inside his bedding. He set the alarm on his watch to 7:30. A couple hours' sleep would have to be enough to get him through another long day. They came for him just after 5. The minivan slid to a stop at the bottom of the hill. To the passengers, it seemed as if the driver had been out of control on the slick streets for virtually the entire 2.5-hour drive from Zurich. The driver's lack of skill in such conditions was understandable. There was black ice on the road, and the visibility was next to nil at times. Plus, these Middle Easterners' orders were to get onto the blinking dot on their GPS as fast as possible, and the tech was calling them on the satellite phone every 10 minutes for an update. There were 5 of them. Libyan external security officers from the Jamahiriya Security Organization, a fire team from the best of Gaddafi's men. All ex-army commandos each knew his Scorpion SAVZ-61 machine pistol like a trusted friend.
The leader was 41, stern-faced, and bearded, dressed in civilian adventure attire, like the rest of his team. He sat in the passenger seat, incessantly barked admonitions at the commando behind the wheel, unforgiving of the man, though all knew the driver was more accustomed to negotiating desert dunes in an armored jeep than he was icy mountain switchbacks in a minivan. Still, they made it to Guarda in good time and parked their vehicle in the lot by the train station at the bottom of the valley. The driver lifted the hood and quickly removed the distributor rotor and threw it into his gym bag, thereby rendering the vehicle useless until he returned. They then found the little road up the hill, spread their formation as wide as possible across it, and began their ascent on foot. Each man carried his little scorpion in a gym bag with its stock folded and a backup pistol in a shoulder holster. Different operators carried different grenades and breaching charges as well. They all wore knit caps, heavy cotton pants, and the same black parkas, an expensive name brand associated with professional athletes. Also in their gym bags were night vision goggles. They remained stowed for now. The five Libyans climbed the steep, winding road to the village in the dark. They moved quickly and efficiently. Any passerby would know from their near uniformity and the severe facial expressions bobbing up and down in the vapor of their exhalations that they were up to no good. But no locals walked the hillside road at 5:30 in the morning in a snowstorm, so the Libyans arrived, undetected, into the cobblestone streets of the Swiss hamlet. Each operator also had a small handheld radio attached to his belt and connected to an earpiece. With a single command from their leader, they separated on the western edge of Guarda, continued individually to the east, each through a different little pedestrian passageway. This tactic ensured that anyone looking out their window would only see one of the men. If an alarm was raised and the villagers began to talk about strangers, they all might well think they saw the same individual. On the far end of the town, the kill squad reformed like a biologic entity, detached cells rejoining in a petri dish. The leader consulted his GPS and turned to the left at an unpaved track that continued from the ledge on which the tiny hamlet was situated, up the hillside and into the forest, only visible in the distance after they donned their night observation devices. The leader updated the team from the information on his GPS.
400 meters.
The snow had picked up even more. The swirling bands of flakes had turned to thickening sheets of falling white. The Libyans had seen snow before, during training in Lebanon or on other missions in Europe, but their bodies were wholly unaccustomed to this cold. 48 hours earlier, this very team of operators had sat in a Tripoli apartment working with an electronic surveillance detachment to try to locate the source of a ham radio broadcast emanating from the city that had made comments critical of Colonel Gaddafi. It had been nearly 100 degrees in that cramped room, so the cold of the eastern Swiss valley was a shock to their systems indeed. They almost passed the shack. Only the GPS coordinates provided by the tech had saved them from hours of wandering through the woods. By now the scorpions were out of their gym bags. The bags were hanging from their backs. The weapons' folding stocks were deployed, and the guns were raised to the low, ready position, stocks pressed against their shoulders, and sights just below the sightline of their night vision goggles. Each man took a careful position around the cabin. They reported in, one by one. The leader was first.
1 in position, 10 meters from the door. No movement. The windows are shuttered. 2 is with 1. 3 on the west side. 1 window, shuttered.
4 at east side. 1 window, shuttered.
5 at back. No windows, but there is a utility shed alongside the main building. A secure padlock on the outside. Nothing else back here.
The leader said,
5, stay at the back. Find cover and be ready. 3 and 4, come to the front door. We will enter as a team. Understood.
Gentry slept dreamless in his sleeping bag next to the hole in the floorboards that led to the earthen basement.
The pain meds had dulled the ache in his thigh and given him the respite needed to relax. His sleep was deep, restful, brief. The leader retrieved a fragmentation grenade from his belt. He pulled the pin and moved slowly to the front door with his hand on the spoon. Two was in front and preparing a breaching charge when he noticed the door was not completely shut. He turned to his leader and motioned to the crack in the door. The leader nodded, turned to the two men behind him, and whispered,
"It's open. Get ready."
Number two pushed the door open quickly and knelt down so that other weapons could train on any targets inside. It was completely dark at first. Even the night vision equipment could not make out the features inside. One lobbed the grenade into the room underhanded. Two, three, and four stepped to the edges of the cabin to avoid the blast. The grenade left the leader's hand and disappeared into the dark, but the sound of the missile's impact with a hard surface came too early. As the leader made to turn away from the door, the grenade reappeared in his night vision goggles, bounced out of the cabin, and landed in the snow in front of the door. Fortunately for the Libyans, all four saw the sputtering grenade in time. They dove for cover, either to the snowy ground or around the edges of the cabin. The explosion whited out the goggles of the three men facing in the weapon's direction, and a fourth man was hit in the elbow and knocked down by a small piece of shrapnel. Collecting himself quickly, the leader ripped his now useless goggles from his eyes, returned to the edge of the door, and entered, firing into the dark. Number two and then three followed, but within 2 seconds, the leader's shout made the others stop dead in their tracks.
Manthrap!
Chapter 17. Moments before Gentry had dropped exhaustedly to his sleeping bag for the night, he'd slid the large wall of rusty mesh to its position 2 feet inside the front door. The 7-foot-high contraption weighed over 200 pounds and slid along a 3-foot track on the floor. On each end of the fence, there was a hinged wing, and each wing locked to a clasp on either side of the door. This effectively created a barricade capable of slowing down a breaching team, forcing them to bottleneck at the most dangerous point of any breach, the doorway. The man-trap was here when Court inherited the cache, and he had not placed much value in its capabilities due to the fact that it could easily be blown apart with explosives or knocked over with a battering ram or even a few serious blows from a boot heel. But as he leapt out of his sleeping bag to a crouch after the grenade went off out the front door, he immediately knew the rusty old barricade had just saved his soundly sleeping ass. Frantically, he kicked the 2 duffels of gear by his sleeping bag back down the hole to the tiny basement. He grabbed the Brueger and Tomette and fired a full magazine at the front door with one hand before sliding down into the hole. Once in the 6-foot-deep cellar, he reached above and pulled the floorboard lid over himself. Number three knelt over bloody snow to the left of the shack's entrance. The grenade fragment had hit him squarely in the elbow and passed through both meat and bone. But he was a disciplined soldier. He made little noise and quickly packed a handful of snow on the wound, wincing only with the shock of cold on skin, because he could not yet feel the pain he knew was soon to come. Number one ignored his injured man as he ordered two to set the fuse on his entire stock of breaching explosives and toss them through the doorway. A few seconds later, a tissue box-sized block of Semtex came to rest at the edge of the man-trap's slide rail on the floor. The three uninjured Libyans at the front of the shack turned to run, and numbers two and four each grabbed three under an arm and lifted him off the ground as they scrambled for cover. It was quiet in the black forest for a few seconds. The only sounds to be heard were the gentle hiss of snowflakes striking pine needles and their fallen brethren already on the ground, and the panting of the kill squad from Tripoli, now tucked tightly behind a fallen oak. The black night and the soft sounds were replaced with a white flash and an ear-splitting explosion that made the earlier hand grenade blast sound like the pop of a champagne cork. The doorway to the cabin, from the floor below to the slat roof above, blew to pieces, and lumber and fresh pine trees blew forward, landing as far away as 100 feet from the building. Bits of burning debris floated down with the snowfall through the pines as 1, 2, and 4 penetrated the wreckage of the cabin. Each man fired a burst or two as they entered the torn hole in the front wall. 1 went to the right, 2 to the left, and 4 moved straight through the small building. They used the light from burning fabric and paper to negotiate their footfalls over a blown-down metal fence, a smashed bookcase and table, several boxes and cooking utensils, and myriad unrecognizable objects. Once the 3 were sure there was no one alive in either the main room or the little bathroom, they began kicking over and through the debris on the floor, searching for the scorched and shredded body that surely must lie among the ruins. 5 checked in to confirm all was quiet at the back of the cabin, as the 3 Libyans inside began to worry. It was a small shack. Even in the deep shadows from the fires, it took less than 10 seconds to verify there was no body to be found. 1 looked to the ceiling. In a second, he determined there was neither a loft nor an attic. Slowly, he looked down to his feet.
There's a trap door here. Find it.
2 did find it, next to the overturned furnace, after kicking a few coal bricks away. The fires were burning themselves out, so 1 turned on an electric lantern that had fallen from a shelf but had miraculously survived the explosion. He placed it on the floor next to the trap door.
Careful. He may have set a surprise for us. Unless there is a tunnel through this mountain, he is trapped.
2 and 4 nodded. Their confidence grew. The gray man was hiding like a rat below them. Number 5 stood behind a thick pine at the back of the structure. 20 feet in front of him was the padlocked storage shed. It stood 5 feet high alongside the cabin, but it was clearly not attached to it. He checked in with the men inside. They were about to lift the trap door with a long metal pole. Then they would toss grenades in, follow that with rifle fire, and then finally climb down to cut off their target's head. 5 was missing all the action. He cursed aloud at the snow around him. His scorpion waited at the low ready. Suddenly, he heard the coughing of an engine coming to life inside the cabin. No, not inside the cabin. In the storage shed. Just as his eyes moved down to the doors of the shed, a loud boom barked through the forest. The padlock blew forward and off, and the doors flew open wide. Number 5 had just begun to lift his submachine gun to his eye when the motor noise screamed, and a large figure launched into the air from the darkened recesses of the small shed. The young Libyan soldier had never before seen a snowmobile. The bullet-shaped vehicle crashed back to the ground a few feet in front of him, and he dove to the side, rolling in the snow and slamming his back hard into a fallen stump. He looked up in time to see a human form on the back of the vehicle, leaning forward with a mask on his face and a large pack on his back. The image in his night vision goggles was a blur, and the blur was gone in a single second. The Libyan scrambled for his submachine gun, but he'd lost it in the fallen needles and accumulating snow. By the time he'd gripped his weapon and lifted it to his face, the black shadow was disappearing over a tiny rise, tearing through snow and shrubbery and small saplings, and flinging everything in its path to the left and right of its skids.
5, report!
Came 1's scream through the earpiece.
He's here! He's back here! He's heading up the mountain! Shoot him!
5 began running up the hill.
Come help me! He's on a motorcycle with skis!
The gray man knew he had to turn the snowmobile around and go right back down past the hit squad. The forest ended abruptly at a huge rocky wall on the top of the hill. He could perhaps find a place to hide in the woods for a while. But he knew all of Guarda was awake and calling the local constabulary a few kilometers away in Kur. It would take them a while to get there and most of an hour to get a real force in all the way from Davos. But Cort had no intention of waiting around for minutes, much less hours.
Shit!
He screamed into the icy air. He'd already left 1 of the 2 packs of gear behind. He could not fit it through the 3-foot-long, upward-sloping, dirt-walled tunnel from the dirt basement to the tool shed where he kept the snowmobile. He'd grabbed a sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun from the cache to use to blow open the padlock from the inside, and now the powerful weapon rested in front of him between the handlebars of the snowmobile. He was also furious because he knew there was only one other person alive who knew of the existence of this cache. Donald fucking Fitzroy. Sir Don had offered court the established cache's location soon after the gray man joined his stable. The venerable English handler admitted at the time that the availability of the cache was due to the fact that the man who'd erected and used the hidden cabin no longer needed it, as he'd been found dismembered in a shallow grave somewhere just outside of Vladivostok. Gentry hadn't worried about the bad omen, and he'd accepted the gift of the shed from Fitzroy. He liked the central location, the seclusion of the village and the valley, and the fact that any approaching vehicle could be heard for hundreds of yards if it was on wheels, or for miles if it was under propeller power. It had been a good cache. It would have remained so, Gentry was certain, had Don Fitzroy not given up his location to the men trying to kill him. The snowmobile ran out of snow 40 seconds after heading up the mountain away from the killers. Gentry turned hard to avoid the granite wall a dozen feet high that ran both left and right. He used his feet and the throttle to turn the machine back around, facing towards the forest and cabin below, and then the village beyond. For now, Court was protected by the lip of a hillock. He could not see down to the men with the guns and the bombs, and they could not see up to him. But they were surely at this moment negotiating their way up the icy, unpaved road. He had no idea if there were 2 men, or 5, or 15, or 50. He only caught a brief glimpse of one at the rear of the shack, but he was hardly certain he hadn't passed more men in the woods, and, anyway, the bulk of the action had seemed to be at the front door. Court considered his options for a moment. He looked around at his predicament, and immediately pronounced himself trapped. He could fight a few of them, maybe, but the wide expanse in front of him over which they would surely come was a disadvantage. If they spread across the frozen meadow and approached simultaneously in a wide line, he would not be able to engage targets at his left, right, and center before they could gun him down. High ground was supposed to be a tactical advantage, but Gentry saw this high ground sucked. Off to his right, there was another way down the hillside. A sheep trail, not more than 4 feet wide and incredibly steep, dropped more or less in a straight line through the forest towards the meadow on the other side. But the grade was far too sheer for the snowmobile to negotiate. Even trying it would be suicide. Now Court heard voices below him, shouts of men, wild in the frenzy of the hunt. They were moving up the road to him, closing on his cornered position.
"He's got nowhere to run!"
shouted number one. He didn't bother with his radio. The noise from the explosion and the gunfire had withered his and his men's hearing for the rest of the night. He just shouted out to the 3 men around him jogging up the slippery road. Number 3 had been left behind at the cabin. He'd wrapped bandages over his injury, and he was lucid and ambulatory, even if out of the fight. The 4 Libyans nearing the crest of the rise above them quickly dropped their magazines from their scorpions and checked them for sufficient ammo. Professionally, they reseated the clips and clicked them back into place. Their night vision goggles covered their eyes. The steady snowfall gave movement to the green view ahead. They slowed as they neared the top, spread quietly across the road without waiting for instructions to do so. Suddenly, the engine noise of the snowmobile screamed again. It revved higher and grew louder, and then, in front and above the 4 Libyans, a single headlight appeared, glowed like a green specter in their night vision optics as it barreled down towards them.
"Open fire!"
screamed number 1 with a shriek. The 4 assassins knelt into crouches and poured rounds at the oncoming vehicle. 20 rounds a second of hollow point ammunition sprayed from each of the 4 braying guns. Tracer rounds arced and struck and bounced into the sky like rocket-powered fireflies. At 30 meters distance, the vehicle left the ground. It floated to 25 meters and then came down hard, bounced again into the air, and then landed on its side. The light stayed on as the machine slid down the hill past the 4 Libyans and came to a stop 20 meters behind them. The engine idled. Hot gases poured from the motor and hazed the men's optics. Number One ran to the snowmobile after reloading his weapon. He slipped on ice and fell to his knees. Number Two passed him as he got back up. A quick scan around the road by all four men confirmed their suspicions.
He's not here!
There was a moment when Court thought he might have been sliding at 50 miles an hour. Everything seemed faster at ground level, of course, and the snow and ice and crunchy bits of stick and grass that flew into his face no doubt added to the perception of speed. But whatever the actual velocity, Gentry knew he was descending the sheep trail way too fast. It was hard to part with the second duffel worth of gear, but he'd seen no alternative. He'd dumped the weapons and the grenades and the binoculars up there on the ice. He lashed the sawed-off shotgun to the handlebars to keep them straight and then used a length of cord to tie the throttle open. He watched the machine leap over the edge and down the road. Then he ran as fast as possible across the snow along the shelf, along the granite wall, to where the sheep trail began and led down at nearly 20 degrees through the forest, through the lower meadow, and then to the little village, still dark, still an hour from the first hues of dawn over the mountains to the east. At a full sprint, Gentry leapt through the air, his injured feet first, holding the big canvas duffel bag behind his backside, and landed on the snow. The grade was especially sheer at the beginning. He'd lost control almost immediately, but found his position again at a slightly less severe stretch of trail that proved to be all too short. On the hillside to his left, he could hear the gunfire and sense the flashes of light, but he did not turn his head away from his feet and what was in front of him. For nearly 100 yards, he'd been happy with his plan. He sledded quickly out of the kill zone, and in truth, it wasn't a bad plan, really, but as it turned out, its execution was wanting. When he skidded into the woods, the pine roots crossed the sheep trail, and he was sliding too fast to stop. He went airborne at an ice patch over a root knob, and his body flung 90 degrees in the air. He landed on his side, perpendicular to the direction in which he was traveling, and this sent him spinning, rolling over and over. His bandaged knees took his body weight in a glancing blow as he spun. His feet caught a snowdrift, and this jerked his body around 90 degrees more. He found himself head first, his duffel bag sled was long lost behind him now, and he shot out of the forest and into the meadow above the old village of Guarda, with his hands out in front of him, like Superman, and with absolutely no control over his momentum. The slide, in its entirety, lasted just over 45 seconds. To Gentry, it seemed like a lifetime. When it was over, he lay on his back in the snow. After taking a few seconds to control his vertigo, he sat up, checked his body for functionality, and then stood unsteadily in the black morning. He took stock of his pain. The bullet wound in his right thigh throbbed more than usual. He was certain he'd reopened any flesh that had rejoined in the last 2 days. His knees stung. They were likely bleeding. His ankles hurt, but seemed to be operational. His ribcage on the right side flared with ache when he sucked in a breath of the cold mountain air. He thought it likely he'd cracked one of his floating ribs, which would be painful but not particularly burdensome. His left elbow seemed to have hit something, or a series of somethings, or every goddamn something on the mountainside, and the area along his funny bone was stiff and swelling. With all that taken into account, the gray man knew he was fortunate to find himself in such good condition. Sliding, rolling, and bouncing down a steep hillside in the dark could have gone much worse, even without the gunmen firing machine guns at him. Then he took stock of his belongings. His buoyed spirits sank anew. He'd lost everything but the small Walther handgun in his ankle holster, his wallet snapped shut in his back pocket, and a folding knife in his front pocket. Everything else, sat phone, medical equipment, extra ammo, guns, grenades, binoculars, all gone. It took him another 20 minutes to get to the bottom of the valley, down to the one road and the one railroad track to the one-room train station. The snow had turned to sleet, and he shivered, his ungloved hands buried deep in his pockets. He saw a minivan, the only vehicle parked in the tiny lot. He took this as the kill squad's vehicle. He broke the driver's side window and climbed in quickly, then smashed the steering column apart with two kicks of his boot heel. In seconds, he had the ignition barrel out, and in under a minute, he'd sparked the ignition wires. But the van wouldn't start. Hurriedly, he felt around under the dash for a kill switch. Finding none, he climbed back out of the van, slammed the door shut, and jabbed his knife into each of the tires. He knew sabotaging it would show the gunners he'd made it down this far, and was certainly on the road by now, but, he decided, they would have to leave Guarda immediately anyway. The police would be arriving within minutes. The kill team wouldn't be able to search the forest for him all morning, so there was little use in trying to mislead them that he was still on the mountain. As it stood, he figured they were no more than 10 to 20 minutes behind him now, depending on how concerned they were about being detected by the villagers, or how nervous they were about bumping into the first police cars coming up the hillside. Cort broke a small window pane in the door to the train station, reached around, and opened the latch. First, he checked a schedule on a wall, a timetable for all the trains in the country. Then, he pulled a heavy brown coat off a coat stand. Gentry slipped it on. It was a little tight at the shoulders, but it would keep him alive. A woman's bicycle with thick tires leaned against a wall, and Gentry took it, closed the door behind him, and winced along with the flare-up of pain in his lower ribcage when he kicked a leg over to mount it. It was after 6, and he knew the trains would not begin running through the valley until 7. He needed to make it to a larger village to get the first express train of the morning to Zurich. So he biked west on the Engadine Road, away from the hint of a faint orange daybreak behind him. His lower back, right thigh, and left knee burned with each revolution of the pedals. His face stung in the cold. He leaned into the snowfall, dead tired and wounded and disheartened. He'd wasted an entire day going after documents and weapons, and he'd acquired nothing but injuries. Still, there were few men on earth who could summon determination in the face of adversity as well as the haggard and bloody man in the ill-fitting coat on the woman's bike. He had no plan, no gear, no help, and now he was certain he had no friends. Fitzroy had lied to him, had set him up. Cort knew he had every right to disappear and leave Don to whatever had hold of him, whatever made him burn his number one asset. But Cort decided to continue to the west, if only for now. He knew he needed a better understanding of what was going on, and he only knew one way to get it. Chapter 18. Shortly before 6 a.m., London time, Sir Donald Fitzroy looked out the portside window of the Sikorsky and down at a green meadow. As the helicopter raced at an altitude of just a few hundred feet, the landscape dropped away, and whitecaps and dark water appeared 1,000 feet down. Below him were the white cliffs of Dover, the end of the British Isles, and the beginning of the English Channel. He and Lloyd and Mr. Felix, the representative of President Abu Bakr, along with the tech and the forlorn group henchmen, flew south towards Normandy. The 68-year-old Englishman did not know why. Additional incentive, Lloyd had said an hour earlier. On the off chance the Libyans botch the job in Switzerland, and Cort changes his mind, tells you that for all he cares, your family can go to hell. Then I have another lure I'll use to reel him in. Before Fitzroy could question further, Lloyd was on the phone ordering a helicopter fueled for a flight across the channel to be sent immediately to Battersea Heliport. Sir Donald traveled to the continent often, occasionally by aircraft from Gatwick or Heathrow, sometimes by the Eurostar high-speed train through the channel, but he much preferred the overland and oversea route. A train south through Chatham and then to Dover, on to a ferry to Calais in France, or Ostende, or Zeebrugge in Belgium. This was the old way, the way of his youth, and neither the quick and easy airlines nor the modern expediency of the tunnel under the North Sea could compare with the feeling of pride and love that he felt when he returned to England on the ferry and, in the distant haze over the water, he could see the white cliffs of Dover in all their majesty. Was there anything so beautiful in the world to an Englishman? and above the cliffs, white birds soared, welcoming travelers over the channel much as they had returning aircraft of the Royal Air Force 70 years before, the thin airframes pocked with holes and filled with young boys who had just killed and died and risked all for Her Majesty in the air war against fascism. Now Donald gazed with melancholy out the port side window, watched the beauty of Dover slip away behind him in the moonlit pre-dawn, and he knew he would likely never see this view again.
"I just got the word from Regal. The Libyans have failed."
It was Lloyd speaking over the intercom, his voice bleeding through the earphones of the headset that pinched the tufts of white hair on either side of Sir Donald's head. Fitzroy looked around the cabin and found Lloyd on the other side, facing back to him. Their eyes met in the dim red glow of the cabin lights. Fitzroy noticed the young American's suit had wrinkled in the past 24 hours. His necktie now hung loose around an open collar.
"How many lives lost?"
asked the Englishman.
"Zero, surprisingly. One man injured. They are saying the Gray Man is a ghost."
"The comparison is not without merit," said Fitzroy into his microphone.
"Sadly, no. Ghosts are already dead."
Lloyd sniffed.
"I'm sending the Libyans to Bayou to supplement the coverage there on the outside chance Gentry makes it through our gauntlet."
Fitzroy shook his head.
"Forget it. I was the only one who knew about the cache in Switzerland. He will know it was I who tipped the assassins off. Knowing that I've been double-crossing him all along, he will not be so inclined to save my family."
Lloyd just smiled.
"I've prepared for this contingency."
"Are you bloody daft? He won't come to my rescue. Can't you understand that?"
"That is no longer my plan."
Lloyd turned away, conferred with the tech. The helicopter raced over the channel, and the moonshine flickered on the water below like a tray of loose diamonds. At 7 in the morning, the Sikorsky crossed directly over Omaha Beach, the site of the most bloody of the D-Day landings. Nearly 3,000 young American men died in the water and on the sand and in the bluffs off the beach below them. Lloyd did not look out the window. He was talking to the tech over the helicopter's intercom radio. Sir Donald listened but said nothing. Lloyd authoritatively barked orders, orchestrating the movements of the surveillance experts like chess pieces on a board. He ordered the tech to send all kill teams now east of Guarda to the west of Guarda, Zurich, Lucerne, Bern, Basel. As the road between Gentry's starting point and objective shortened, the 10 hunter-killer units still in the fight had less territory to cover.
"Let's move the Venezuelans from Frankfurt to Zurich. Have the South Africans head to Bern on the off chance he turns south. Who's in Munich? Then Gentry has already bypassed the Botswanans. Let's pull them all the way back to Paris. They can support the Sri Lankans on site there. The Kazakhs are in Lyon, right? Lyon is too far south, but we'll stage them there till we get more intel. Make sure they're near the highway and ready to head north. Send another detail of surveillance to Zurich and double-check Gentry's known associates list. Who else is in Paris?" "Well, I don't care how good he is. One man is not enough. Gentry has lots of history there. I want 3 teams in Paris plus the Korean." "The Korean hasn't checked in." "Don't worry about it. Just keep sending him updates. He's a singleton operator. He won't be calling in lonely."
Claire sat on the edge of her bed and worried. It was 7:30 a.m. The full shine of the morning was still a half hour off. She'd slept only because last night her mother had made her drink some awful green cough syrup. When she woke, it was still dark. She'd wondered where she was at first. Then, one by one, she remembered the terrible events of the day before, culminating in the short drive from the family villa in Bayeux to the large old chateau with the huge gate and the long driveway and the green lawn. She remembered the big men in the leather coats speaking the strange language and the scared looks of Daddy and Mummy, despite their continued assurance that everything was just fine. Claire checked to make sure her sister was sleeping next to her. Kate was there. She'd choked down a mouthful of cough syrup, too.
Claire sat on the edge of the bed and looked out the window. The only movement was the huge man below her in the gravel car park at the side of the castle. A big gun hung around his neck, and he finished one cigarette after another out of his coat, smoking constantly. Now and then, he talked into a walkie-talkie. Claire knew what the radio was. She remembered the American, Jim, who'd stayed with her family when she was little. He'd had a radio, and he'd showed her and her sister how to press the button and talk into it like a telephone, with her mom answering the other end in the back garden. These men around her were nothing like Jim the American. Although she could not remember everything about his time in her house, she remembered he was nice and friendly, where these men had angry and unhappy faces. Last night, before Mummy made the girls drink the cough syrup, Kate had wanted to go exploring throughout the castle. Claire went along, but she was not playing like her silly sister. The angry men all but ignored them as they walked through the kitchen. Kate beat on pots and pans with a spoon because they echoed wildly in the massive chateau. They wandered down endless wooden-floored corridors and turned back from some because they were too dark and spooky. They found a cellar full of dusty wine bottles, and they found a big library full of huge leather books, and they found room after room where the walls were lined with the heads of large, scary animals with fur and horns and huge teeth. An orange cat ran down the hall, and they followed it down into the basement, watched it push open a little window high on a wall above a shelf, and let itself outside and into the back garden. Next, the girls discovered a spiral staircase that wound up and up and up, and they climbed to the top of a tower. There, they turned on a light, saw a man at a table sitting in a chair and looking out one of the open windows into the dark. He had a radio next to him, and he had a big gun in front of him. He'd yelled at the girls in that ugly foreign language, and Kate laughed and ran back down the stairs. Claire followed her sister, but her heart pounded in her chest. The man had barked into his radio, and soon men came and got the girls and took them by their arms to their parents' room. In English, one of the big men told Daddy to put his girls to bed, and Daddy had yelled back at the man, told him to keep his hands off, and then stormed out on the balcony while Mummy brought Kate and Claire into the bathroom to drink the medicine. It had been an awful day and an awful night, and now that Claire had awakened, she knew it had been no bad dream, and today would likely be just as horrid. As Claire sat at the edge of her bed in the low light and worried, she thought she heard a funny noise in the distance. Soon it was louder, came closer to the chateau. The skies above her home in London were filled with helicopters, so it didn't take her long to identify the distinctive sound of a propeller. She stood with her face to the window. The helicopter came over the woods on the far side of the big fountain in the big back garden. Its black rotors spun above its white body as it approached the far edge of the gravel car park. Then it turned to the side, landed on its wheels, and sank down. The door on the side opened, and four men in suits climbed out. The whipping wind of the helicopter blew open one man's suit coat, and even from 60 meters, Claire could see the pistol holster against the man's white shirt. More men with guns. As the blades whipped above them, four more men stepped out of the chopper. The first man was black and wore a brown suit. The next man hauled two suitcases. He had a long ponytail and ran forward towards the chateau. Then came a man carrying a briefcase. He was thin and wore a black suit with a raincoat over it. His shiny black hair was short and messy in the wind, and Claire could tell even in the distance that he was someone important. The way he looked about, stormed forward on the balls of his feet, and gestured to those around him. The next man who exited the helicopter was larger, older, bald, except long white hair around his ears that lashed around below the spinning propellers. Claire pressed her face to the glass, squinted to get a better look. Then she shouted out loud, waking Kate behind her with a start. though she'd somehow managed to sleep through the helicopter's approach and landing.
Grandpa!
Fitzroy was allowed a minute with his son and daughter-in-law in the kitchen on